This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guests are Billie Eilish and Finneas O'Connell. As you probably know, they're siblings who write songs together. She sings on their albums, he produces and plays several instruments. They've been writing and recording together since she was 13 and he was 18. Considering the number of records they've broken in the last few years, they're more than popular. They're a phenomenon. Their album, When We All Fall Asleep, Where Do We Go?, was the second in Grammy history to win in the major categories Best Record, Album, Song, and New Artist, all in the same year. Finneas was the youngest person to receive a Grammy for Producer of the Year, non-classical. Billie was the youngest to win two Oscars, one for the theme for the Bond film No Time to Die, and another for What Was I Made For from the Barbie movie. She collaborated on both songs with Finneas. They're continuing to break records. Billie was the youngest most listened to artist on Spotify this year. Their latest album, Hit Me Hard and Soft, is now nominated for 6 Grammys, including all the major categories. Each of its tracks reached over 150 million streams on Spotify. Finneas also has an independent career as a producer and recording artist. His second solo album was recently released, called For Crying Out Loud. Billie spent her teen years in front of her fans and the press. In 2019, music critic John Pareles wrote in the New York Times, Eilish, age 17, has spent the last few years establishing herself as the negation of what a female teen pop star used to be. She doesn't play innocent or ingratiating or flirtatious or perky or cute. Instead, she's sullen, depressive, death-haunted, sly, analytical and confrontational, all without raising her voice. Let's start with a song from Hit Me Hard and Soft. This is L'amour de ma vie, which is French for the love of my life.
I wish you the best for the rest of your life. Felt sorry for you when I looked in your eyes. But I need to confess, I told you a lie. I said you of my life, the love of my life. Did I break your heart? Did I waste your time? I tried to be there for you, then you tried to break mine. It isn't asking for a lot for an apology, for making me feel I could kill you if I tried to leave. You said you'd never fall in love again because of me. Then you moved on immediately.
Billie Eilish, Finneas O'Connell, welcome to Fresh Air. It's a pleasure to have you on the show. Billie, it strikes me you're singing more in a fuller voice. What's changing about your voice and how you choose to use it?
Well, you know, we started making music when I was about 13. And as most 13-year-olds, I had not, you know, grown into my body and my voice and all the things that you age into as a human. And I always, you know, it's funny, like when things like that happen at a young age, you kind of have this idea that that's how things are going to be forever. And so in my mind at the time, my voice was going to sound like it did then forever. I thought it was going to be soft and my range wasn't going to be like very big and I wasn't ever going to be able to belt and I wasn't ever going to be able to, you know, have much of a chest mix in my voice. And, you know, I spent many years touring and singing and doing shows and my voice matured and started to change. And in the making of Hit Me Hard and Soft, I started working with a singing teacher, which I hadn't done since I was a kid in my choir. And I kind of always like felt hesitant to and kind of embarrassed to somehow. And it completely has just honestly changed my life. And I mean, my voice has just gotten, you know, 10 times better in the last 2 years. And what's amazing is it's just going to keep getting better.
Did you want to do a whispery voice? Was that like a style choice or just like that's the way your voice
No, went? That's just how I sang. That's what's funny about it. I just, you know, I was like, I couldn't really do much else. Like I didn't have the range. I didn't have the strength in my vocal cords and my breathing, you know. And think about, you know, how your voice sounded when you were a kid opposed to now. It's a completely different thing.
Yeah. And Phineas, I assume you do the arrangements.
Yeah, like the production and the instrumental arrangement. I would say that I do plenty of it, but Billy is deeply involved. And I would say that as time has gone on, Billy has become kind of more knowledgeable and articulate about what she likes and what she doesn't in instrumental arrangement and production and vocal arrangement. So we're either brainstorming stuff together or at the very least she's reacting to, you know, what I do in a kind of a, I like that, go further. I'm not crazy about that, you know, take that out kind of a sense, if that makes sense.
I want to play a track because I like the instrumentation, the arrangement so much. And it's called The Diner. So Phineas, do you want to say a little bit about the instrumental track of this?
The Diner is a slight anomaly in terms of the way that Billy and I most commonly work. I would say the way that we most commonly work is I sit down with a guitar or I sit down at a piano and I play chords and Billy sings melodies and we come up with lyrics and melodies together over top of chords. In the case of The Diner, on my own, I had made what became sort of most of the instrumental of The Diner. I'd been sitting around one day playing that sort of sampled, rearticulated horn thing. You take kind of a one track of a horn being played, and then you load it onto a keyboard, and the horn is then chromatic on the keyboard, and you play the bup, 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 bup. That's me playing piano, but through a horn sample. And then I programmed drum samples and then bass samples, or I guess not bass samples, but bass synthesizers over top of that. And I presented it to Billy. And then she riffed, you know, these super menacing, cool lyrics over top of it.
So let's hear The Diner. That was The Diner from the new Billie Eilish album, Hit Me Hard and Soft. And my guests are Billie Eilish and Phineas. Phineas, you're not on all of the current tour that Billie is on, and you've just released your second solo album. Does that have significant meaning in terms of the nature of your music partnership?
Well, I think if I go back to the kind of genesis of this, first of all, we lived together. We both lived at home with our parents when we started making music. I was 18 and Billy was 13. And over the ensuing, you know, years, even after I moved out into my own place as a 21-year-old, we still made most of the music in the bedroom in my childhood home. And as time went on and Billy's tour became a more and more heavy lift, she started to need to be more kind of diligent about how much vocal rest and physical rest she was getting on the road, which meant that we were making less music on the road. And the sort of turn of the tide there was that we would come off the road and had made nothing new. And then we'd kind of have a detox at home where we would, you know, have just spent every day together for several months and we'd kind of chill out. And then we'd sort of reconvene and start making new music. And then we'd go back out on the road. And so it just became a kind of a version of like, wow, this is going to dominate every minute of my life. And I feel that I'm really not the, you know, best pianist, guitarist, backup singer, accompanist for Billy. You know, that's not the thing that is my sort of special skill there. My special skill is being able to write and record songs with her. And so if I am picking between the two and I have other stuff on my plate, I'll pick making the album every time.
Billy, can you talk a little bit about when you were a teenager and you had all these like teenagers, especially teenage girls, as like such dedicated fans? What was it like for you to grow up as a teenage star with so many teenage listeners kind of idolizing you? And then judging from what I've seen and read about you, you've been kind of insecure about yourself, not necessarily of your music, but, you know, for any insecurity you have, to have all these people turning you into an idol must have been, well, maybe was, a little disorienting.
Definitely. I think, though, honestly, even though it was a lot for a young brain and body to deal with, in a way, the fact that I was a teenager and they were also teenagers somehow felt less kind of, I don't know, I think I just felt so connected to them because we were all the same age. And I think it can be really hard when you're an adult and you have fans that are children to you or, you know, way older than you. Like, I think that something about us all kind of feeling like we were growing up together was like honestly comforting to me. And also, I didn't really have many friends for a couple of years. And
well, you were homeschooled, so it's not like you were hanging out in the schoolyard or in the classrooms with your peers.
Well, so this is what's interesting is we were homeschooled. We didn't go to school, but Phineas and I both had so many friends growing up and we did so many things and there was no shortage of friends. There was no shortage of activities and, you know, things to do, which I think can be surprising for people to hear because they kind of think like, well, then how did you meet them? And, you know, we had all sorts of things we did. I was part of a choir and I was in a dance company and we did aerial arts and I rode horses and I did gymnastics and I acted and Phineas acted and I was in a, you know, there were so many things that were social for us. And honestly, when I became famous-ish at 14, it was not a good time in terms of like keeping friendships. I think when you're 14, that's kind of an age where friendships are already kind of rocky. And also all my friends did go to school. So like they were all going to high school and suddenly I had no way of relating to anyone. And I kind of lost all my friends. And I maintained a couple, but those were really challenging to keep even still. And so for those few years of becoming this like enormous superstar, I was kind of feeling like, wait, what the hell is the point? I don't have any friends and I don't have like I'm losing all the things that I love so deeply and all the people that I love. And so in a way, the fans kind of saved me in that way because they were my age and I felt like they were the only kind of friends I had for a while.
Phineas, what's it been like for you, especially, you know, early on when Billy was very young and you were still in your teens, your late teens? What was it like for you to have an audience dominated by teenage girls when you're a guy and you're also older? You know, you're 4 or 5 years older than Billy?
Yeah, I'm 4 years older. So I would say that I didn't have much of a kind of a feeling one way or the other about the age or gender of the predominant audience. I had a real sense of gratitude for their enthusiasm. You know, the audience that was coming to the shows that Billy was playing couldn't have been more engaged and enthusiastic.
Billy, I've read that some girls or, you know, young women in the audience are throwing their bras onto the stage when you perform. How often does that happen? Do you have any idea how that started?
I mean, that's like a classic.
Well, it used to be panties that, you know, women would throw at male stars, you know.
Right. Well, it's funny, like, I always envied that. I remember, like, watching, you know, videos of men performing, whoever they may be, and, you know, people throwing bras and underwear, and, you know, and I always thought, like, oh, that's so awesome. it's so sick, so powerful. I always was just jealous of that, and I remember when I was first doing shows, you know, fans throw all sorts of things on stage. They throw gifts and presents and different flags of different kinds. And honestly, like, right away, people started throwing bras when we were all, me and the audience, 16. And I loved it. I really did. You know, I spent many years having a lot of not gender dysphoria about my own gender, but I think a lot of women go through the feeling of, you know, just envying men in any kind of way, one way or the other. And for me, I would watch videos of different male performers on stage and just feel this like deep sadness in my body that I'll never be able to, you know, take my shirt off on stage and run around and like not try very hard and like, you know, just jump around on stage and that's enough. And, you know, have enough energy from just myself with no backup dancers and no, you know, huge stage production and the crowd will still love me. And that's just like only a man can do that. And because of that, I think more than almost anything else in my career, I was very, very, very determined to kind of prove that thought wrong. And I really did. I really feel like I did. I didn't like the kind of pop girl, leotard, you know, backup dancers, hair done thing. I didn't like that for me. I liked it for other people, but that didn't resonate with me. I never saw myself in those people. And honestly, I never saw myself in any women that I saw on stage, but I did see myself in the men that I saw on stage. And I thought that was unfair. And so I did everything that I could to kind of try to break that within myself and the industry.
But, you know, on a related note, you often dress, you know, on videos and in performance on stage in really baggy clothes. And I was thinking, like, since you grew up with a lot of hip hop, you know, in a lot of hip hop performances on stage and in videos, the dancers or the women in the videos are usually dressed, and especially earlier in the period when you were growing up, were dressed in like really tight and scanty kind of clothes. And the men are wearing like baggy hoodies and pants that are so baggy they're like falling down. And in that sense, did you take your cue from the men in hip hop in terms of dress as opposed to the women?
Yes, exactly correct. I would watch those videos and instead of being jealous of the women who get to be around the hot men, I would be jealous of the hot men, and I wanted to be them. And I wanted to dress like them, and I wanted to, you know, be able to act like them. And to be fair, I had all sorts of women that I looked up to and artists that I, you know, are the reason that I am who I am. And also, I wouldn't have been able, even if I'd felt the way I did, I wouldn't have been able to achieve it had it not been for the incredibly powerful, strong-willed women artists and people in the public eye that came before me that made it possible for me. So, like, my favorite singers are all kind of old jazz singers that I've always looked up to. And
I'm always forcing people to watch videos of Ella Fitzgerald singing live and Julie London singing live and, you know, Sarah Vaughan and Nancy Wilson and all these people. We were watching these videos and every single one, of course, because of that period of time, they're all wearing dresses. They're all wearing tight, you know, corseted, maybe dresses with their hair done. But like they couldn't just not do that. You know, that's part of how things were then. And so thank God that those women came before me, because otherwise I wouldn't have been able to do anything.
Phineas, you have a new album, and I want to play a song from that. So I want to end with Family Feud, because your family is so important to you both, and the way you still operate as a family, because I think your parents are often touring with you, or at least they used to. So this is your song, Phineas. It's from your new album. Do you want to just say a couple of words about writing it?
Sure. We had just finished making Billy's album, and it was about to come out, and I knew that this, you know, multi-year world tour was on the horizon for her and that I wouldn't be on it. I was just sort of thinking about my relationship with her and how kind of public our family had become. And, you know, she's a public figure. I'm a lesser public figure. There's a lot of attention and judgment paid to us both, and especially to Billy. And it was just sort of a rumination on that.
Billie Eilish, Phineas O'Connell, thank you both so much. I really appreciate you coming on our show, and good luck with the rest of your tour.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thanks so much, Terry.
Mom and Dad are out of town. The two of us are grown-ups now. Pepper had to be put down. Hard to take, hard to own. Not hard to break a collarbone. A little late, but not alone. And you're only 22, and the world is watching you, judging everything you do. Just a house and just a room, just a handful of balloons, just another afternoon, just the way it almost was, when it's just the two of us. Sleep all day, I'll wake you up, when it's just the two of us.
That's Family Feud from Phineas's new album, For Crying Out Loud. Billie Eilish and Phineas' latest album together is called Hit Me Hard and Soft. My next guests are Stephen Colbert and Evie McGee Colbert. They're partners in their marriage, as well as in their production company, and she makes regular appearances on his CBS show, The Late Show with Stephen Colbert. During the COVID lockdown, when he hosted The Late Show from their home, she was his partner on the show, acting as a producer, sound engineer, and serving as an audience of one. I loved hearing her laughing at his jokes. They're typically not partners in the kitchen because they have different approaches to cooking. But now they have a new cookbook they co-authored with the great title, Does This Taste Funny? Recipes Our Family Loves. Shrimp are well represented in the book because Stephen and Evie grew up in coastal South Carolina, where they still have a home. Each recipe in the book is preceded by the story behind it and memories associated with it, so you actually learn about Stephen and Evie as you read the recipes. If you watch Colbert's show, you know he likes a good drink. The book has a whole chapter on drinks. Each episode of The Late Show opens with a monologue, typically satirizing a major event in the news. Colbert doesn't pull his punches, especially when it comes to threats against democracy. Stephen, Evie, welcome to Fresh Air. It's such a pleasure to have you back on the show, Stephen, and to talk to you, Evie.
Thank you.
Thanks,
I'm so excited to be here.
It's been too long.
Oh, yeah. So first question to you, Stephen. How do you find time to cook? I can't believe that you find time. I don't have time to cook, and I don't have half the job that you do. I make, like, omelets and heat roasted chicken.
Evie will tell you, it's relaxing for me. That's what I want to do. You know, on a Saturday afternoon, if I've got a moment and I've got it to myself, especially if there's a farmer's market in town or something like that, I want to go get a pork belly and just start marinating that, or start, you know what? I've got some brioche. I've got eggs. I've never done an almond bread pudding before. Let's try that with maybe the crispy top. Ooh, I'll make a cartouche on the top and sort of steam it in a bain-marie first, then I'll take it off. And ooh, what about a bourbon caramel? So like I get, and I don't, what drives Evie crazy sometimes is that then I don't eat it.
Yeah, you're not cooking to make food for yourself. You're just cooking to make a process.
I love process. I love one thing becoming another thing. Well, it's kind of like doing the show. You get there in the morning and there's, I don't know, maybe 9 stories that are generally dominating the conversation over the last 24 hours. We have good pitches on 6 of them, and 3 of them then dominate the monologue because we've boiled it all down. We've taken – that's why I like the show Chopped, because they take – you know, you have these baskets at the beginning of the show where there's like you have octopus and licorice and you have smoked salt. Here, make an entree or whatever. That's what doing the show is like. And kind of you have to love process to do a show on a daily basis, and that's related to – food for me. One thing becomes another thing with a little care, a little love, and a little imagination. And I find it incredibly smoothing. I mean, smoothing. It's also smoothing. It's also bloating. But it's also incredibly soothing to me. And I'll just try to go give the food away.
So, Evie, if Colbert is doing all this cooking but doesn't eat it, do you get to eat it? And do you do a lot of the cooking that you actually both eat?
Well, I do get to eat what he makes, which is often delicious, always.
Often?
Often. I would say often.
Well, I'm experimenting. I'm imagining what it's going to be like, and you know.
Sometimes it doesn't work.
Things don't always work out, Terry.
When I was growing up, my mother wasn't much of a cook, but she had 2 like fantastic dishes that she made. Mm. And I always look forward to those. But Monday nights, I'd almost be in tears because Mondays are bad enough when you're going to school.
Yeah.
And she'd sometimes make broiled mackerel, which is a very bitter fish, especially
yeah.
when
Oily.
You're a kid. Yeah, and with like canned string beans.
Oh, God.
And I know. And lettuce with no dressing on it.
Sure.
Iceberg. I'd nearly be in tears. But later in the week, the food got better. So I'm wondering with each of you, the recipes in your book look absolutely sumptuous, but were there meals that you had that nearly brought you to tears when you were growing up?
Oh, my God.
Oh, yeah.
So especially, yes. When I was a kid, my, you know, again, 11 kids and also Catholic, so, you know, no meat on Fridays. We had so many Mrs. Paul's or like Gorton's fish sticks. I think it was Mrs. Paul's fish sticks growing up. And my mother, her idea of making it fancy, and I'm sure she saw this suggestion, the serving suggestion on like on the back of the package was some partnership with Campbell, because it would take a can of Campbell's condensed tomato soup and you would just heat up the condensed soup and ladle that over the fish sticks as the sauce.
No water. You're supposed to add a can of water.
No, you know, that's if you're making soup, not if you're making a delicious remoulade.
Imagine the salt content.
Oh, exactly. Exactly. I'm a creature of pure sodium by the time I was 10. But, you know, that also, this is the thing that even I, as a child who just would eat anything you put in front of me, spaghetti with ketchup.
Oh, I had that once at my aunt's house.
Oh, my God. We got that all the time. My brothers and sisters loved
it.
I'm like, I don't understand what's happening.
My God.
But I would, of course, have to eat it.
Have you ever brought to tears anticipating something your mother was going to serve for dinner?
Well, yeah. My parents, you know, everything was very local. So we had, I think a lot of Charlestonians love this, is shad roe, which is really hard to get. It's, you know, the roe of a shad fish. And I hated that.
But it would be steamed with vinegar.
They would have that all the time, too.
Seasonally,
yeah.
Evie, are there things you had to sacrifice in your life when Stephen became famous and had this kind of consuming career and you had children?
Wow. Yeah, I think so. I mean, I decided I think I'm incredibly lucky to have been able to be home with our children. But Stephen's hours were really long and difficult, and I felt that I just wanted to be home with them when I could. So I ended up spending a lot of my time as a stay-at-home mother, which I had never expected to do. And it was a real privilege. I think there were sacrifices. I had trained to be an actress, and I decided not to be an actress even before we got married. But then later in life, I had opportunities to do some performing, which I chose frequently not to do because it would take me out of town, and I felt that our family needed somebody at home. I mean, I don't in any way want to suggest I ever felt cheated because it was such a privilege to be able to have the life I had. I feel incredibly lucky that I was with my children and that, I mean, even though Stephen had a busy job, he wasn't gone. He just came home late. So we were always together as a family. And that's, in show business, that's super unusual, you know? So I think we've had an incredibly lucky time, frankly, very blessed.
I can't speak to your experience because that's your experience, but certainly for the business that I'm in, this is one of the more normative jobs you can have because mm-hmm. you know where you're going and you know when you're coming home. Mm-hmm. And the hours may be long, but at least you can plan your life.
Right.
And you're going to be home. I mean, yeah. you're not traveling to different locations.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
Like shooting Game of Thrones.
Right.
Unless they want to cast me. And then to hell with all of this TV stuff, I'm a star.
Hell with the family.
Yeah.
I had someone say to me once, Terry, that I think is so funny. I guess you'd been doing the Colbert Report for a year or two, Stephen, and I was chairing a book fair in our kids' school, and there was an author who said that she wanted to meet me because I was Stephen's wife. And I remember saying to my friend, my life is just getting really weird. This is just weird. And she turned to me and said, the life you ordered has arrived. And I thought it was such a funny way, but it is true. It all comes as a package, right? If you want to be a performer or if you want to be an artist, and with fame comes attention, comes opportunity, but also comes sacrifice of some way.
You're both from prominent families. Stephen, your father died when you were 10. But before that, he'd been a director of a program at the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, mm-hmm. and he worked at the National Institutes of Health. And then the family moved to South Carolina, and he became the first vice president for academic affairs at the Medical University of South Carolina. That was in 1969.
Yeah.
And Evie, your father was a prominent civil litigator. Mm-hmm. He served in the South Carolina House of Representatives for three terms. He was a Democrat. Mm-hmm. Because your fathers were prominent, were you expected to be model children?
Huh.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
I don't think because I'll just speak for me. I don't mm-hmm. think because of who my father was I expected to be a model child. I think the same – I mean, first of all, I think we were all 11 children in the family. I think we were all held to the same standard. I think I had a slightly different relationship with my dad than my other brothers and sisters did because I was the last. They used to say, I can't believe Dad took you to the carnival. Like, Dad hates carnivals. Or, I can't believe Dad went to the beach with you or something like that. But my father had a sense that, you know, this is his last bite at the apple. And to do those fatherly things with me. Because my father died when I was young, it's not so much I was held to a standard that I had to match him, is that when your parent dies when you're young, they become Olympian, or there's something much larger than life, which of course is how a child sees their parent, but you never get to move beyond that. So as you get older, they also get larger. So as your view of the world or what you believe is asked of you to be an adult, at least for me, my father inflated ahead of me and became even grander in a way. And so if there was any standard placed on me, it was placed on me by myself. My mother was not asking me to be a certain person because of who my father was. I did it to myself because of the person I perceived my father to be. And I actually don't think I'm very far off. I think he was an extraordinary man. But I think that's self-imposed on my part.
Mm-hmm. Probably on mine too, actually. I was lucky enough to have had my father for a long time. He just passed away this past April. And at his funeral, when I delivered the eulogy, I mentioned how as a little girl I used to like to put my feet in my father's footprints on the sand. And I think metaphorically that's how I felt about him. I admired my father so much that I always wanted to try to live up to be the person he was. And the same for my mother. I hit the jackpot with my parents. I really love them. And I think for me, it wasn't being a model child. It was being a person who cared about the community that they lived in and gave of themselves and their time to make the world a better place in whatever way they could. And my parents were both selfless, community active. They did a lot in the community, in the town of Charleston.
And for me, because I wanted to know my father, even though I was robbed that ability to move beyond the childhood view of him, because I wanted to know him, I grabbed onto the little things that I did know about him. For instance, my father's idea of fun was to read philosophy. He really would enjoy sitting down with Jacques Maritain or Léon Blois or other French Christian humanists. And so that's what I read. I read a lot of books. I knew that he had lived a life of the mind, so that's what I wanted to do. It was important to be smart. My father was a dean, an assistant dean at Yale Medical when he was 29. He was a full dean at 31 at St. Louis. And so he was this academic superstar, which I never was, but he was this academic superstar and a deep thinker. And I aspired for that in hopes of knowing him. And often it was religiously based. You know, he was Jesuit educated but my mother and my father both profoundly dedicated to their Catholic faith in different ways. My father more intellectually and my mother more sort of mystically in a way, though she also read a great deal, but more Dorothy Day. I think I was most influenced by the little bit I knew that I used as a thread to pull on to try to understand him.
Hmm. Stephen, I've known about your deep faith and Catholicism since The Daily Show, when you were kind of like the religion correspondent and you had a regular feature called This Week in God.
This is the God Machine. Beep, boop, boop, beep,
yeah,
boop, boop.
Yes. And you know, you still... You know, talk about religion on The Late Show, and you satirize religion, you satirize Catholicism, you satirize the Pope. So I was really surprised when the Pope invited you to the Vatican as part of a larger event. And I don't remember what the event was, but Jim Gaffigan was there. I think David Sedaris was there.
Sure, Conan was there. Jimmy Fallon was there. Chris Rock was there.
What was this about?
Well, first, if I could just back up just slightly here, I'm willing to talk about my own faith if my guest asks me about it. I don't like to proselytize. And I'll make any jokes about the Catholic Church. You know, I don't – they deserve a lot of them. And I am deeply Catholic in that it is combed into my being, but I don't know how deeply devout I am. I know people who are really deeply devout, and I wouldn't want to put myself in their league. I just am integrally Catholic, if you know what I mean. And I do love my church, and I still go to church, and I do have a faith. I just don't want to confuse myself with someone who is a very devoted Catholic, but I have become friends with Father Jim Martin over the years, who's sort of like the Broadway priest in New York. And he's the editor of America Magazine. And he was the chaplain of the Colbert Report on the old show. And, you know, we've become dear friends over the years. And he just wrote me one day. I actually got the email right before I went on stage at The Late Show one night saying, hey, the Vatican has asked me to put together a list of like 20 comedians because the Pope wants to meet with some comedians. Would you mind helping with that? And I was like, yeah, sure. So I put a list together of 40 comedians. They sent me back a list of 15 or 20, something like that. Like they'd made their selects of my selects and with a few of their own. And Jim Gaffigan and I called everybody on the list and we said, hey, we don't really know what this is about, but the Pope wants to meet comedians because he thinks that comedians do something valuable in society and he just wants to meet us. Now, I thought we were going to go to Rome and like hang with the Pope. I don't know why I thought that. I thought that maybe we'd like sit there and we'd have coffee or tea with the Pope and he would ask us some questions. Then we would get a photo and leave. It turns out that these were comedians from all over the world. It was like from 60 countries. And the Pope had a meeting in the Apostolic Palace with us. There was, I think altogether was like 110 comedians. And we all didn't know what was going on. And we all sat there and the Pope came in and he gave a beautiful speech about comedy. that we did not understand at all, that we read later, that was about how...
Because it was in Italian?
It was in Solamente in Italiano. And it was about how comedy, I think, eases people's day. And it is like the social lubricant. And it's okay to make fun of God and the church and the Pope and all that kind of stuff, as long as, like, you do it with a smile and there's some intention to make people feel better. And what struck me was...
It's like your philosophy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would like to think so. And what struck me is, and we're in this room, which is about the size of the Sistine Chapel. And it's actually just down the hall from the Sistine Chapel. And it's more Rococo than it is, you know, late Renaissance. But it's beautiful. It's like you're in another Sistine Chapel. And we're all sitting there in our, you know, Sunday best, as it were, waiting for the Pope to come in. But comedians are all iconoclasts. We're all people who have a pretty jaundiced view of authority. And I know that some of the people there weren't Catholic or weren't meaningfully Catholic, in at least by their own description, anymore. And the minute the Pope came in, we all leapt to our feet. Like, the iconoclasm went out the door. We all just leapt to our feet and started applauding and, like, screaming. And I thought, wow, that's the effect the Pope has on 110 comedians. Like, it was almost like an autonomic response, because you've spent all this. It's like the location. It's the red shoes. It's the white outfit. It's all like the guys with the sashes around you. The Pope's gentlemen, who all look like butlers and everything. I was sort of shocked that we all kind of gave into it immediately.
Did you get to meet the Pope one on one?
I did. I memorized something in Italian. I went up and I said, Sancte Padre, you know, Holy Father. My name is Stephen Colbert, and I am the reciting. I'm the voce recitante. I'm the reciting voice for your memoir, Life, because he had released a memoir of his life in the spring. And I had gotten a call from my manager to say, baby doll, you're not going to believe who wants you to do their audiobook. And I'm like, who? And he goes, just guess. I'm like, I don't know. Barbara Streisand. No. And he goes, the Pope. And I go, does it pay? And he goes, you better believe. So anyway, so he negotiates with the Vatican for my contract. And I read the Pope. So I just said, I read your book. You know, I thank so much. I was a reciting voice for your book. And he said, ah, and kind of used his hand to guide me to the side. So that was it. That's all I got. It wasn't that. It was very nice. And he gave me a rosary. We all got rosaries blessed by the Pope.
I'd like you each to leave us with your favorite comfort food.
Mm. Well, most of the book is comfort food.
It is.
There's a lot of butter.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, my favorite recipe in the book is the one that we start with, my mother's cheese biscuits, because those were things that she made always. And so now when I make them, I feel like she's with me, and it's comforting. And I love them. They're wonderful to give, and they're delicious and fattening. I think comfort food should be fattening.
I got so many in there. It's probably the red rice. You know, growing up on the coast of South Carolina, just anywhere in the South, there's so much red rice. And it has its roots in jollof rice of West Africa. But it's super jammy and a little spicy and salty. And I had it almost every day growing up at Stiles Point Elementary School on Michael Drive on James Island, South Carolina, which it's still there. And there were just barrels of it being cooked every day by those lunch ladies. And I never got tired of it. And for right before this book, I actually found a way to make it based on an Allison Roman recipe that I said, ooh, that sauce she's making for the pasta actually has the flavor I remember as a child from this red rice. And I tried it and it worked. And that discovery of being able to get that flavor back from my childhood, those... carefree years is what that rice gives me.
When you say carefree years, do you mean before your father died?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, taste is powerful.
It's true.
Smell is powerful. Yeah.
I think we both enjoyed that rediscovery of recipes that we'd grown up with, which we, you know, we maybe had you know, made them in our adulthood, but not really spent time with them the way we spent time with them writing this book.
And that's what COVID did. We were back there in Charleston on that island with our families, with the people who had taught us to make these and made these for us as we, when we were children, and with those ingredients from that field and that creek. And it was a terrible time that had in it this gift to us, for us to slow down, go home, and remember.
And also working, it sounds like working together so closely on the show worked out okay.
Which we had been so afraid to do, or at least I had been afraid to do, because I was so nervous the first time Evie was on that she wouldn't have a good time. It's actually made it to air, her going, oh my God, you're trembling. I'm like, I'm afraid this is going to be a bad experience for you, because I'm bossy.
No. But we have had fun, you know, and this whole process has been a lot of fun.
And an enormous amount of work, and I just could not be more, I could not have more admiration for the people who do this for a living, because we had no idea what a huge undertaking is to do.
There's a lot of detail in a cookbook.
Oh my God, 3 years to do this.
You have to be right about whether it's a teaspoon or a tablespoon.
You really do. It makes a difference.
Were your recipes fact-checked?
Yes, by a lot of
people. Six ways to Sunday. It went through us. We'd make it many times. And then through our niece, Lucy.
Our niece, Lucy Wickman, was fabulous. And she helped test it, everything.
And then all of that would go on to Chris Styler, who was a professional test kitchen, essentially. And he would say, is this what it's supposed to look and taste like? And we'd go, no. And then he would say, then you need to rewrite this recipe.
Well, I don't cook fancy things or ambitious things, but I enjoyed seeing the recipes. I enjoyed all the anecdotes. So I'm so glad we got to talk. It's just been such a pleasure and a joy to speak with you both.
You too.
Thank you so much.
And to you. Stephen Colbert and Evie McGee Colbert have a new book called Does This Taste Funny? Recipes Our Family Loves. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our co-host is Tanya Mosley. I'm Terry Gross.